Well, today we'd like to read to you from a report given by Pilate to Tiberius Caesar, Emperor of Rome. This is a document said to have come from a manuscript found in the Mosque of St. Sophia in Constantinople in Turkey. This is said to be Pilate's report to Caesar of the arrest, trial, and crucifixion of Jesus. Noble Sovereign, greeting. The events of the last few days in my province have been of such a character that I will give the details in full as they occurred, as I should not be as surprised if in the course of time they may change the destiny of our nation. For it seems of late that all the gods have ceased to be propitious. I am almost ready to say, cursed be the day that I succeeded Valerius Flaccus in the government of Judea. For since then my life has been one of continual uneasiness and distress. On my arrival at Jerusalem, I took possession of the praetorium and ordered a splendid feast to be prepared, to which I invited the Tetrarch of Galilee with the high priest and his officers. At the appointed hour, no guests arrived. This I considered an insult offered to my dignity and to the whole government which I represent. A few days after, the high priest deigned to pay me a visit. His deportment was grave and deceitful. He pretended that his religion forbade him and his attendants to sit at the table of the Romans and eat and offer libations with them, but this was only a sanctimonious seeming, for his very countenance betrayed his hypocrisy. Though I thought it expedient to accept his excuse, from that moment I was convinced that the conquered had declared themselves the enemy of the conquerors, and I would warn the Romans to beware of the high priests of this country. They would betray their own mother to gain office and a luxurious living. It seemed to me that of conquered cities, Jerusalem is the most difficult to govern. So turbulent are the people that I live in momentary dread of an insurrection. I have not soldiers sufficient to suppress it. I had only one centurion and 100 men at my command. I requested a reinforcement from the prefect of Syria, who informed me that he had scarcely troops sufficient to defend his own province. An insatiate thirst for conquest to extend our empire beyond the means of defending it, I fear, will be the cause of the final overthrow of our whole government. I lived secluded from the masses, for I did not know what those priests might influence the rabble to do, yet I endeavored to ascertain as far as I could the mind and standing of the people. Among the various rumors that came to my ears, there was one in particular that attracted my attention. One young man, it was said, had appeared in Galilee preaching with a noble unction a new law in the name of God that had sent him. At first I was apprehensive that his design was to stir up the people against the Romans, but my fears were soon dispelled. Jesus of Nazareth spoke rather as friend of the Romans than of the Jews. One day in passing by the place of Silo, where there was a great concourse of people, I observed in the midst of the group a young man who was leaning against a tree, calmly addressing the multitude. I was told it was Jesus. This I could easily have suspected, so great was the difference between him and those listening to him. He appeared to be about 30 years of age. Never have I seen a sweeter or more serene countenance. What a contrast between him and his hearers with their black beards and tawny complexions. Unwilling to interrupt him by my presence, I continued my walk, but signified to my secretary to join the group and listen. My secretary's name is Manlius. He is the grandson of the chief of the conspirators who encamped in Eretria waiting for Catiline. Manlius had been for a long time an inhabitant of Judea, well acquainted with the Hebrew language. He was devoted to me and worthy of my confidence. On entering the praetorium, I found Manlius, who related to me the words Jesus had pronounced at Silo. Never have I read in the works of the philosophers anything that can compare to the maxims of Yeshua. One of the rebellious Jews, so numerous in Jerusalem, having asked if it was lawful to give tribute to Caesar, he replied, "Render unto Caesar the things that belong to Caesar, and unto God the things that are God's." It was on account of this wisdom that I granted so much liberty to the Nazarene, for it was in my power to have him arrested and exiled to Pontius. But that would have been contrary to the justice which has always characterized the Roman government and all of its dealings with men. This man was neither seditious nor rebellious. And so I extended to him my protection, unknown perhaps to myself. He was at liberty to act, to speak, to assemble, address the people, even to choose disciples, unrestrained by any Praetorian mandate. Well, should it ever happen, may the gods avert the omen, should it ever happen, I say that the religion of our fathers will be supplanted by the religion of Jesus. It will be this noble totalitarian that Rome shall owe her premature death. Well, I, miserable wretch, will have this instrument of what the Jews call providence and we call destiny. The unlimited freedom granted to Jesus provoked the Jews, not the poor, but the rich and the powerful. It is true that Yeshua was severe on the latter, and this was a political reason, in my opinion, for not restraining the liberty of the Nazarene. Scribes and Pharisees, he would say to them, you're a race of vipers. You resemble painted sepulchres. You appear well unto men, but you have death within you. And other times he would sneer at the alms of the rich and proud, telling them that the mite of the poor was more precious in the sight of God. Complaints were made daily at the Praetorium against the insolence of Jesus. Well, I was even informed that some misfortune would befall him, that it would not be the first time that Jerusalem had stoned those who called themselves prophets, an appeal would be made to Caesar. However, my conduct was approved by the Senate. I was promised a reinforcement after the termination of the Parthian War. Now, being too weak to suppress an insurrection, I resolved upon adopting a measure that promised to restore the tranquility of the city without subjecting the Praetorium to humiliating concession. I wrote to Jesus requesting an interview with him at the Praetorium. He came. You know that in my veins flows the Spanish mixed with Roman blood, an inescapable fear as it is of weak emotion. When the Nazarene made his appearance, I was walking in my basilic, and my feet seemed fastened with an iron hand to the marble pavement. I trembled in every limb as does a guilty culprit, though the Nazarene was as calm as innocence itself. When he came up to me, he stopped, and by a signal sign he seemed to say to me, I am here, though he spoke not a word. For some time I contemplated with admiration and awe this extraordinary type of man, a type of man unknown to our numerous painters who have given form and figure to all the gods and the heroes. There was nothing about him that was repelling in its character, yet I felt too awed and tremulous to approach him. Jesus, I said at last, and my tongue faltered. Jesus of Nazareth, for the last 3 years I've granted you ample freedom of speech, nor do I regret it. Your words are those of a sage. I know not whether you have read Socrates or Plato, but this I know, there is in your discourses a majestic simplicity that elevates you far above these philosophers. The emperor is informed of it, and I, his humble representative in this country, am glad to allow you that liberty of which you are worthy. However, I must not conceal from you that your discourses have raised up against you powerful and inveterate enemies. Nor is this surprising. Socrates had his enemies. He fell a victim to their hatred. Yours are doubly incensed against you on account of your discourses being so severe upon their conduct, against me on account of the liberty I have afforded you. They even accuse me of being indirectly leagued with you for the purpose of depriving the Hebrews of the little civil power which Rome has left them. Well, my request, I do not say my order, is that you be more circumspect and moderate in your discourses in the future, more considerate of them, lest you rouse the pride of your enemies and they raise up against you the stupid populace and compel me to employ the instrument of law. The Nazarene calmly replied, Prince of the earth, your words proceed not from true wisdom. Say to the torrent to stop in the midst of the mountain gorge. It will uproot the trees of the valley. The torrent will answer you that it obeys the laws of nature and the Creator. God alone knows whither flow the waters of the torrent. Verily I say unto you, before the rose of Sharon blossoms, the blood of the just shall be spilt. Your blood shall not be spilt, said I, Pilate, with deep emotion. You are more precious in my estimation on account of your wisdom than all the turbulent and proud Pharisees who abuse the freedom granted them by the Romans. They conspire against Caesar and convert his bounty into fear, impressing the unlearned that Caesar's a tyrant and seeks their ruin. Insolent wretches. They are not aware that the wolf of the Tiber sometimes clothes himself with the skin of the sheep to accomplish his wicked designs. I'll protect you against them. My praetorium shall be an asylum, sacred both day and night. Jesus carelessly shook his head and said with a grave and divine smile, When the day shall come, there will be no asylums for the Son of Man, neither in the earth nor under the earth. The asylum of the just is there, pointing to the heavens. That which is written in the books of the prophets must be accomplished. Well, young man, I answered mildly, you will oblige me to convert my request into an order. The safety of the province, which has been confined to my care, requires it. You must observe more moderation in your discourses. Do not infringe my order. You know the consequences. My happiness attend you. Farewell. O Prince of the Earth, replied Jesus, I come not to bring war into the world, but peace, love, and charity. I was born the same day on which Augustus Caesar gave peace to the Roman world. Persecutions proceed not from me. I expect it from others and will meet it in obedience to the will of my Father, who has shown me the way. Restrain, therefore, your worldly prudence. It is not in your power to arrest the victim at the foot of the tabernacle of expiration. And so saying, he disappeared like a bright shadow behind the curtain of the basilica, to my great relief, for I felt a heavy burden on me, of which I could not relieve myself while in his presence. To Herod, who then reigned in Galilee, the enemies of Jesus addressed themselves to wreak their vengeance on the Nazarene. Had Herod consulted his own inclinations, he would have ordered Jesus immediately to be put to death. But though proud of his royal dignity, yet he hesitated to commit an act that might lessen the influence with the Senate, or, like me, was afraid of Jesus. But it would never do for a Roman officer to be scared by a Jew. Previously to this, Herod called on me at the Praetorium. On rising to take leave after some trifling conversation, asked me what was my opinion concerning the Nazarene. I replied that Jesus appeared to me to be one of those great philosophers that great nations sometimes produced, that his doctrines were by no means sacrilegious, and that the intentions of Rome were to leave him to that freedom of speech which was justified by his actions. Herod smiled maliciously and, saluting me with ironical respect, departed. The great feast of the Jews was approaching, and the intensity was to avail themselves of the popular exaltation which always manifests itself at the solemnities of a Passover. The city was overflowing with a tumultuous populace clamoring for the death of the Nazarene. My emissaries informed me that the treasurer of the temple had been employed in bringing the people. The danger was pressing. A Roman centurion had been insulted. I wrote to the prefect of Syria for 100 foot soldiers and as many cavalry. He declined. I saw myself alone with a handful of veterans in the midst of a rebellious city, too weak to suppress an uprising, having no choice left but to tolerate it. Well, they had seized upon Jesus, and the seditious rabble, although they had nothing to fear from the Praetorium, believing, as their leaders had told them, that I winked at their sedition, continuing vociferating, "Crucify him, crucify him." Three powerful parties had combined together at that particular time against Jesus. First, the Herodians, the Sadducees, whose seditious conduct seemed to have proceeded from double motives. They hated the Nazarene, and they were impatient of the Roman yoke. They never forgave me for having entered the holy city with banners that bore the image of the Roman emperor. And although in this instance I had committed a fatal error, yet the sacrilege did not appear less heinous in their eyes. Another grievance also rankled in their bosom. I had proposed to employ a part of the treasures of the temple in erecting edifices for public use. My proposal was scorned. The Pharisees were the avowed enemies of Jesus. They cared not for the government. They bore with bitterness the severe reprimands which the Nazarene for 3 years had been continually giving them wherever he went. Well, timid and too weak to act by themselves, they had embraced the quarrels of the Herodians and the Sadducees. Beside these three parties, I had to contend against the reckless and profligate populace, always ready to join a sedition, to profit by the disorder and confusion that resulted therefrom. When Jesus was dragged before the high priest and condemned to death, it was then that the high priest, Caiaphas, performed a divisionary act of submission. He sent his prisoner to me to confirm his condemnation and secure his execution. I answered him that as Jesus was a Galilean, the affair came under Herod's jurisdiction, and ordered him to be sent thither. The wily tetrarch professed humility and was protesting his deference to the lieutenant of Caesar. He committed the fate of the man to my hands. Soon my palace assumed the aspect of a besieged citadel. Every moment increased the number of the malcontents. Jerusalem was inundated with crowds from the mountains of Nazareth. All Judea appeared to be pouring into the city. I had taken a wife from among the Gauls who pretended to see into futurity. Weeping and throwing herself at my feet, she said to me, "Beware, beware, and touch not that man, for he is holy. Last night I saw him in a vision. He was walking on the waters. He was flying on the wings of the wind. He spoke to the tempest and to the fishes of the lake. All were obedient to him. Behold, the torrent in Mount Kedron flows with blood. The statues of Caesar are filled with genocide. The columns of the interim have given away. And the sun is veiled in mourning like a vestal in the tomb. Ah, Pilate, evil awaits thee. If thou wilt not listen to the vows of thy wife, dread the curse of a Roman Senate, dread the frowns of Caesar." By this time the marble stair groaned under the weight of the multiple. The Nazarene was brought back to me. I proceeded to the halls of justice, followed by my guard, and asked the people in severe tones what they demanded. "The death of the Nazarene," was their reply. "For what crime?" "He has blasphemed. He's prophesied the ruin of the temple. He calls himself the Son of God, the Messiah, the King of the Jews." "Roman justice," said I, "punishes not such offenses with death." "Crucify him, crucify him," cried the relentless rabble. The vociferations of the infuriated mob shook the palace to its foundations. Well, there was but one appeared to be calm in the midst of the vast multitude. It was the Nazarene. After many fruitless attempts to protect him from the fury of his merciless persecutors, I adopted a measure which at the moment appeared to be one that could have saved his life. I proposed, as it was their custom to deliver a prisoner on such occasions, to release Jesus, let him go free, that he might be the scapegoat, as they called it. But they said Jesus must be crucified. I then spoke to them of the inconsistency of their course of action, being incompatible with their laws, showing that no criminal judge could pass sentence of a criminal unless he had fasted one whole day, and that the sentence must have the consent of the Sanhedrin and the signature of the president of that court, that no criminal could be executed on the same day his sentence was fixed, and the next day, on the day of his execution, the Sanhedrin was required to review the whole proceeding. Also, according to their law, a man was stationed at the door of the court with a flag, and another a short way off on horseback to cry the name of the criminal and his crime and the names of his witnesses, and to know if anyone could testify in his favor. And the prisoner on his way back to execution had the right to turn 3 times and to plead anything in his favor. I urged all these pleas, hoping that they might awe them into subjection. But they still cried, "Crucify him, crucify him." I then ordered Jesus to be scourged, hoping this might satisfy them. It only increased their fury. I then called for a basin, washed my hands in the presence of the clamorous multitude, thus testifying that in my judgment Jesus of Nazareth had done nothing deserving of death, but in vain it was his life those wretches thirsted for. Often in our civil commotions have I witnessed the furious anger of the multitude, but nothing could be compared to what I witnessed on this occasion. It might have been truly said that all the phantoms of the infernal regions had assembled at Jerusalem. The crowd appeared not to walk, but to be borne off and whirled as a vortex, rolling along in living waves from the portals of the Praetorium even unto Mount Zion, with howling screams, shrieks, vociferations such as were never heard in the seditions of the Panoia, or in the tumults of the forum. By degree the day darkened like a winter's twilight, such as had been at the death of the great Julius Caesar. It was likewise the Ides of March. I, the continued governor of a rebellious province, was leaning against a column of my basilica, contemplating a way to thwart the dreary gloom these friends of Tartarus dragging to execution the innocent Nazarene. All around me was deserted. Jerusalem had vomited forth her indwellers through the funeral gate that leads to Germanica. An air of desolation and sadness enveloped me. My guards had joined the cavalry, and the centurion, with a display of power, was endeavoring to keep order. I was left alone. My breaking heart admonished me that what was passing at that moment appeared rather to the history of the gods than that of men. A loud clamor was heard proceeding from Golgotha, which, borne on the wind, seemed to announce an agony such as was never heard by mortal ears. Dark clouds lowered over the pinnacle of the temple, and setting over the city, covered it as a veil. So dreadful were the signs that men saw, both in the heavens and on the earth, that Dionysius is reported to have exclaimed, "Either the author of nature is suffering, or the universe is falling apart." Whilst these appalling scenes of nature were transpiring, there was a dreadful earthquake in Lower Egypt which filled everybody with fear and scared the superstitious Jews almost to death. It is said Balthasar, an aged and learned Jew of Antioch, was found dead after the excitement was over. Whether he died from alarm or grief is not known. He was a strong friend of the Nazarene. Before the first hour of the night, I threw my mantle around me and went down into the city toward the gates of Golgotha. The sacrifice was consummated. The crowd was returning home, still agitated, it is true, but gloomy, taciturn, and desperate. What they had witnessed had stricken them with terror and remorse. I also saw my little Roman cohort pass by mournfully, the standard-bearer having veiled his ego in token of grief. And I overheard some of the Jewish soldiers murmuring strange words which I did not understand. Others were recounting miracles, like those which have so often smitten the Romans by the will of the gods. Sometimes groups of men and women would halt, and looking back toward Mount Calvary, would remain motionless in expectation of witnessing some new prodigy. I returned to the praetorium, sad and pensive. On ascending the stairs, the steps of which were still stained with the blood of the Nazarene, I perceived an old man in a suppliant posture. Behind him several Romans in tears. He threw himself at my feet and wept most bitterly. It's painful to see an old man weep. And my heart being overcharged with grief, we, those strangers, wept together. And in truth it seemed that the tears lay very shallow that day with many whom I perceived in the vast concourse of people. I never witnessed such an extreme revulsion of feeling. Those who betrayed and sold him, those who testified against him, those who cried, "Crucified him, we have his blood," all slunk off like cowardly curs and washed their teeth with vinegar. As I told that Jesus taught a resurrection and a separation after death, if such should be the fact, I'm sure it commenced in this vast crowd. "Father," said I to him, after gaining control of my feelings, "who are you? What's your request?" "I'm Joseph of Arimathea," he replied. "I'm come to beg of you upon my knees the permission to bury Jesus of Nazareth." "Your prayer is granted," said I to him. And at the same time, I ordered Manlius to take some soldiers with him to superintend the interment, lest it should be profaned. A few days after the sepulchre was found empty, his disciples proclaimed all over the country that Jesus had risen from the dead as he had foretold. This created more excitement even than the crucifixion. As to its truth, I cannot say for certain, but I have made some investigation of the matter, so you can examine for yourself and see if I am at fault, as Herod represents. Joseph buried Jesus in his own tomb. Whether he contemplated his resurrection or calculated to cut him another, I cannot tell. The day after he was buried, one of the priests came to the praetorium and said they were apprehensive that his disciples intended to steal the body of Jesus and hide it. And they make it appear that he had risen from the dead, as he had foretold, and of which they were perfectly convinced. Why send him to the captain of the royal guard, Malchus, to tell him to take the Jewish soldiers, place as many around the sepulchre as were needed? Then if anything should happen, they would blame themselves and not blame the Romans. When the great excitement arose about the sepulchre being found empty, I felt a deeper solicitude than ever. I sent for this man, Islam, who related to me, as near as I can recollect, the following circumstances. They saw a soft and beautiful light come over the sepulchre. He at first thought that the women had come to embalm the body of Jesus, as was their custom. But he could not see how they had gotten through the guards. While these thoughts were passing through his mind, behold, the whole place was lightened up, and there seemed to be crowds of the dead in their grave clothes, who all seemed to be shouting and filled with ecstasy, while all around and above was the most beautiful music he had ever heard. And the whole air seemed to be full of voices praising God. All this time there seemed to be a reeling and swimming of the earth, that he seemed to sicken and faint, and he could not stand on his feet. He said the earth seemed to swim from under him. His senses left him, so he knew not just what did occur. Though I asked him what condition he was in when he came to himself, he said he was lying on the ground with his face down. I asked him if the dizziness might not have come from being wakened up and getting up too suddenly, as it sometimes has that effect. He said he had not been asleep, as the penalty was death to sleep on duty. He said some of the soldiers slept at a time and some were asleep then. I asked him how long the scene lasted. He said he did not know, but he thought nearly an hour. I asked him if he went to the sepulchre after he had come to himself. He said no, because he was afraid that just as soon as relief had come, they would go to their quarters. I asked him if he had been questioned by the priests. He said he had. They wanted him to say it was an earthquake, that they were asleep, offered him money if he would say the disciples came and stole Jesus. But he saw no disciples, and he did not know that the body was gone until he was told. I asked him what was the private opinion of the priests he had talked to. He said some of them thought that Yeshua was no man, that he was not a human being and not the son of Mary, that he was not the same that was said to be born of the virgin in Bethlehem. It seems to me that if the Jewish theory be true, these conclusions are correct, for they are in accord with this man's life as is known and testified by both friend and foe, for the elements were in his hands the same as the clay in the hands of the potter. He could convert water into wine. He could change death into life. He could calm the sea, still the storms, call up fish with a silver coin in its mouth. Now I say, if he could do all these things, which he did and many more, as the Jews can testify, and it was doing all these things that created enmity against him, he was not charged with criminal offense, nor was he charged with violating any law, nor of wronging any individual in person. And all of these facts are known to thousands, as well as by his foes as by his friends. I'm almost ready to say, as did Malchus at the cross, truly this was the Son of God. Now, noble sovereign, this is as near the facts in the case as I can arrive at. And I've taken pains to make this statement very full, so you may judge of my conduct upon the whole, as I hear that Antipater has said many hard things against me in this matter. With the promise of faithfulness and good wishes to my noble sovereign, I am your most obedient servant, Pontius Pilate.